Thank you very much, and thank you, Dr. Patterson, for inviting me to come and talk about this particular five-year program that we are currently engaged in. Before I start, I'd like to thank Mallory Robert, someone known to a lot of you as Mallory Heaton, for putting this information together, for pushing me pretty hard to cooperate with her to get it together and to get me down here to present this. We have an office in Kansas. We also have an office in Oklahoma. And I'd just like to introduce Sarah Simpson and John Harms. They're here from our office in Oklahoma to support me, and I appreciate that. Sarah doesn't know it, but Mallory has asked me to tell her to slow me down, make sure I don't skip any slides, and not to screw it up. So with that, I'll start this program. We're here to talk about embryo genotyping and the impact on pregnancy creation. This is a project we've been working on for 5 years. We continue to do it. Genotyping with bovine embryos is really centered in two areas. Historically, it's been with gender determination. The first genetic test for gender determination in embryos was created in 1988. It was presented to the public in 1989. And most of the actual embryo gender determination was really done in the 1900s and early 2000s. If you look back at our American Embryo Association meetings, you won't see much evidence of embryo biopsying for gender determination for the last 10 years or so. Well, 5 years ago, some things happened in the cattle industry that caused a need, or an apparent need anyway, for us to get back into the embryo biopsying business and to supply samples for a DNA lab to determine status of defect carriers. And that's when we started this project. You've heard a lot about the progress of genetics in the last two conversations. What I would just like to talk about is that when we started doing this carrier status of embryos from carrier donors, we were trying to do two things. We were salvaging some bloodlines. We were salvaging some bloodlines primarily because of rules within a breeding association that put some pretty strict limitations on which calves could be registered out of those cows. And it made sense at the time that we collect donor cows, biopsy embryos, and only accumulate embryos that were not carriers for their respective genetic defects. The obvious two genetic defects that got the most attention were the arthrogryposis multiplex and the neuropathic hydrocephalus. The bulk of what we've done has been centered with those two particular defects. We've also done some with the others listed, and there are other PCR tests available for other genetic defects in cattle. You know, historically, genetic defects took a long time to identify, and that process was speeded up with progeny testing. Dr. Leipold had some great herds of cattle back in the 70s and 80s that were affected with non-lethal defects that progeny testing was done. Well, now we can do it so much faster, and we can even do it on the next generation, and that's where genetic testing of embryos comes into play. I want to talk about the procedure a little bit. I think to go through this procedure will help all of us understand what the impact on pregnancy production is when we go through this process. And so we're going to talk about the procedure. We'll talk about the goals that we had going into this five-year project and why we established some of those goals. And then we do have some results that hopefully can at least show you what the impact has been. So the procedures, we bring carrier donors into our facility, and in most cases they're mated to non-carrier bulls for the specific defect. We do embryo collections at 7 days. Became very important for us to do actual 7-day collections. We didn't want embryos to get very advanced. It proved in our hands, which you'll see in just a moment, that by biopsying advanced embryos, embryos that were larger, embryos that didn't have quite the structure this embryo on the screen has, that we needed to concentrate on 7-day collections. The process begins once we've identified a group of embryos from our carrier donor. Those embryos are moved to our biopsy station. Our biopsy station, we try to get away from our main embryo working areas. It's an area that we want to have very clean. We want to not have extra airflow, and particularly we don't want a lot of commotion. This is kind of a tedious process. The people like Mallory that did this process didn't need other people bothering her so that she would get this whole process done correctly. They're moved into the station. There's a couple unique things we have to do with the embryos before we biopsy them. We have to rinse them. We have to rinse them in this particular media that removes a lot of the protein from around the embryo. And that rinsing and washing and removing extra media around the embryo and putting a particular electrostatic-type media around the embryo allows that to sit on the bottom of the plate and not roll around when we touch it with our blade, which you'll see in a moment. Those embryos are loaded into a small droplet, about a quarter cc of splitting media, and then they're moved to our micromanipulator stage and they're prepared to be biopsied. This machine on the left is our micromanipulator. It has two sets of controls, has some really coarse controls that allow us to move our blade quite a bit, and we do use a micro blade, which you can see in the middle, and it's truly just a razor blade. This particular machine also has a joystick for really fine control. So what the process requires that we do is that when we get our embryo into our droplet, use our coarse controls, get our microblade down onto the droplet, get it positioned over the embryo, and at that point start using the fine controls or the joystick. And blade position is very important. We want the blade to be plumb, if you will. We also want it to be parallel with the bottom plate so we make a nice, smooth cutting exactly how many cells we think we're cutting off. The next picture shows a cut that has been done on the left, and the bottom piece of the structure is the biopsy sample that we will send in. The top piece is the remaining embryo. It's our attempt to get about 8 to 10 cells cut off of an embryo to be sent into the lab. At the time that this biopsy is taken, the next procedure is to pick up that really small piece, move it to a PCR plate. In that PCR plate, we have 10 microns of media with it, and all the embryos that are being biopsied that day will be put in their individual plate wells. They'll be identified. That plate will be sealed, be frozen, and then be shipped. The remaining embryo will then be prepared to be frozen. We shipped all of our biopsy samples during this program to Dr. Jonathan Beaver at University of Illinois. He cooperated with us and continues to cooperate with us, sending these small quantities of samples to him. We also opted to freeze almost all the embryos. This because we didn't run the PCRs, it would take 3 to 7 days to get information back. We weren't willing to tie up recipients with embryos that might be carrying the defect, so all embryos were frozen. And we just used a standard freezing program as we would with any embryos and stored the embryos until we got information back. Information back would come to us as is described on this particular screen. We know from the first collection this particular animal was tested for idiopathic epilepsy, and out of 8 embryos, we had 4 embryos that were free for that defect. The bottom animal was tested for hydrocephalus, and I don't have the count on them, but most of the embryos in that collection were free. We also were getting gender determination from Dr. Beaver's analysis on all these samples, which was a benefit to some of our clients. So what were we really trying to accomplish? We knew if we were testing for genetic defects, we're going to biopsy every embryo that we would freeze, because if we didn't biopsy, we'd just throw it out. So if there was anything we determined to be feasible, we would biopsy. We wanted to accomplish at least a 90% determination rate. And that's not something we just dreamed about. As we looked through the information back in the 90s and early 2000s, there were a couple reports that had done retrospective examinations of biopsies for gender determination, thousands of embryos. And what they found was that between 91 and 93% of the embryos had a determination made. So we thought that was a goal that we needed to try to accomplish. Again, recognize that over 25 years, biopsy techniques have changed a little bit, equipment has changed, so we wanted to make sure our equipment could at least stay with historical standards. And that we hope to maintain an acceptable pregnancy rate with the biopsy, frozen, and then thawed embryos. So how did we do? As you can see with this chart, that most of the collections we accomplished were with AM and NH, the bulk of them. The others were really pretty insignificant. As we look down at the bottom of the graph over to the right, we had 125 out of 1,499 samples we didn't get a determination made on. So that was 8.33%. We accomplished greater than our 90% goal. These same samples, plus some additional samples, were sent in for the gender determination. And when we looked at the results of our gender determination, we had a little over 92% of those determined for gender as well. So our biopsy, all that told us was our biopsy technique, our shipment methods were adequate to get the DNA test done. So just as a summary with that, out of 3,061 DNA tests requested, we had 2,800 that were confirmed, 261 that were not. So we were in excess of 90%. Actually, 91.5%. Just a curious slide. Don't know what it means. Haven't analyzed it statistically. We had quite a few more free AM embryos than carriers. Didn't really expect that. We expected more as the line of NH presented to us, but that's how we ended. One curious mating that we had, we collected a donor cow that was a carrier for both traits, TH and PHA, and she was mated to a bull that was positive for TH. The only thing the client wanted to avoid was any affected embryos, and we did have one category, the bottom category, the THAs were affected. We were able to find that out through Dr. Beaver's lab, that embryos were either carriers or they were affected. Didn't do many of those. But ironically, we only had one out of 11 that was free for both. So, you know, and then we have to look at what this conversation wanted us to evaluate, and that's what's the effect on pregnancy creation. And there is some effect on pregnancy creation. Historically, if you look at the reports from the 90s and 2000s with the gender determinations, that there was as much as a 10% of negative impact on embryos that had been biopsied, frozen, and transferred at a later time. And sure enough, we saw the same thing. The 48.2% pregnancy creation with those embryos was what historical industry standards would be. It's 10% less than what we'd expect our average frozen embryo to be. So there is an impact of cutting that biopsy off and then freezing what's the remainder of the embryo. I do want to come back to this slide in just a moment, though. So we have to look at where are we going to go after this five-year period of time. Quite honestly, we had not biopsied for gender determination before this program started. And I've been doing this for 30 years. I don't think we'll biopsy. Particularly with the use of sex-sorted semen. Pretty sure that's why there was a pretty big need for us to do it the last 5 years. Whether that will continue in the future or not, I don't know. But something really interesting that's come up in the last two conversations that I want to go back to. If you see here, we created 745 embryos that were non-carriers. Well, we only transferred We only transferred 274 embryos. We only have pregnancy information for 274 embryos. A couple of things that have happened in the 5 years, and one of them was just predicted about 15 minutes ago. We were biopsying embryos for known genetic defects, had embryos in the tank with information about those defects, and another defect comes along. So now those embryos are sired by bulls that were free of the first defect but are carriers of a second defect. So we have a lot of embryos in the tank that won't be used because, as it turns out, 2 years later, they got hit with another defect. So should we have done that process? You know, that's a question that we've asked, and it just got asked again today by the previous speaker. The other thing that happens with a lot of these embryos, since we were doing gender determination, fairly quickly we got to transferring female embryos and not worrying about the males. You know, the people that were involved in this process were really interested in getting their cows replaced with multiple females from genetic-free bulls and embryos that were genetically free of any defect. So we left a lot of male embryos in the tank. So that's why there's so few transfers with the number of free embryos that we have. So that's really the end of this conversation. I think that we have had a negative impact. By the same token, I think in the short period of time, we accomplished some pretty interesting things for some clients. We created females where they were efficiently. We created females where they weren't going to be created in numbers. And for that, I'm glad. Whether we do it again in the future or not, I honestly don't know. Thank you.